Welcome to Teneo Insights, a podcast that provides in-depth analysis on the issues that matter most to CEOs and their businesses. I'm your host, Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo's political risk advisory business. Let's get started.
William Hague is with me today. Lord Hague is the former Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom, and he's the former leader of the Conservative Party. So those two positions alone qualify him to weigh in on two of the biggest stories of the day, obviously the future of Boris Johnson's government and the ongoing crisis surrounding Russia and Ukraine. After leaving government and public life in 2015, William remains extremely active. Indeed, he's the author of numerous political biographies. He writes a weekly column in the Daily Telegraph, and he works very closely with Prince William, the Duke of Cambridge, as chairman of the Royal Foundation, and works together with him as well on combating illegal wildlife trade globally. He's also a longtime senior advisor and friend of Teneo. And William, thanks for joining me. It's good to have you back on Insight. So it's good to see you.
Hello, Kevin. Great pleasure.
I have to start with the UK here and Boris Johnson and his government. Now, clearly, you know, there's a lot going on in the world. And so, as you well know, and I would think that government instability is sort of one of the most unwelcome distractions that one could have. And I also suspect that Americans, you know, probably exhausted from the kinds of things that can happen at the executive level that don't wind up removing someone from office, can sort of sit here in wonderment over, like, oh wow, really? A few garden parties could actually bring down a government. But on the other hand, I suspect nothing gets under the electorate's skin like moral hypocrisy can. So, what's going on? How do you read the situation right now?
It is an extraordinary situation. I think looking at the whole history of British politics, there hasn't been something quite like this. That there have been many occasions when prime ministers have been in big trouble, and indeed when they've been forced out by their own parties. And of course, Margaret Thatcher was an extreme example of that. 1990, Theresa May was in effect forced out by her own party just 3 years ago when Boris Johnson came in. But those have always been about the policy and direction of the government and the country. What's different about this one with Boris Johnson is that the Conservative Party is broadly supportive of the policy and direction of the government of the country, but is still on the edge of throwing out the prime minister. And the prime minister who won a huge election victory just 2 years ago, why is that? That's because of a problem, a perceived problem of the culture at the top of government. And these latest revelations about parties being held when the country was locked down, and even the Queen was sitting on her own at the Duke of Edinburgh's funeral, you know, and then it turned out that some people were having a party in government offices the night before. That has come on top of other errors of about culture, about integrity in government. I won't go over them all now in the interest of time, but it's on top of other things. So this has made the Conservative Party very angry about Boris Johnson, and the party is going through an agony at the moment. I talked to a lot of members of Parliament last night, and They're a herd which is waiting for the herd instinct to develop. They will charge in one direction or the other the next few days. At the time that we're speaking, Thursday, I'm just saying that for anybody who listens to this afterwards, it's really going to be Monday now before a very important report comes out, the Sue Gray report on Boris Johnson. And then he has his chance to take the initiative, show what he's going to do to clean up the culture of government. That's his big moment and chance, complicated by a police investigation going on now as well, which might take weeks. But really, what is the takeaway for anybody listening in America who thinks, well, what does all this mean? It means it's 50-50, really, whether Boris Johnson's position as prime minister can survive. But it's not really about the policy of the Conservative Party and government. There are potential replacements for him. And I think there are two risks. One is a fiscal risk that in all this trouble in the Conservative Party might weaken on its fiscal conservatism. Some people might think that's not a risk, but it's a good thing. They might go back on recently announced tax rises without going back on the spending rises. So a loosening of the fiscal position. And the other risk, of course, is that the Conservative Party gets into such a mess with this, and it carries on for months, that the Labour Party do much better, become more likely to win the next general election. And in the business and financial world, that would have policy implications. Again, some people might think that's a good thing, but it would be different. And so those are the two substantive risks in this huge fuss that's so hard to follow about the British Prime Minister.
And what's your perception of, you know, is this something that is completely captivating the entire country and electorate, or is it one of these things that this is an issue in Westminster and amongst the chattering classes and the like, but that everybody else is kind of, as in much of America, kind of has this cynical attitude toward the leadership in Downing Street and in Westminster, and they kind of carry on? Or is there truly sort of some righteous outrage over this sort of moral transgression, I guess you could call
it? Yes, I think there is a lot of that outrage. You know, this has really shifted the position of the British parties in opinion polls. Much more than anything else that has happened in the last 2 years. So for the last 2 years, the Conservatives have been steadily ahead in the poll, even through everything about COVID. This has really shifted. This is the first time the Labour Party, under their fairly new leader, Keir Starmer, has gone ahead by about 10 points in the polls. This is one of those stories that really cuts through. As you say, often people think, oh, that's just something going on in the political world. But this really means something for everybody who couldn't have a birthday party, for everybody who couldn't visit their dying relative in hospital on a day when it turned out a party was going on behind the scenes. We can all imagine why that is an issue that cuts through. Of course, there is a defense of Boris Johnson in parts of the media and the Conservative Party along the lines of, wait a minute, we're on the edge of a war in Ukraine. We have these massive decisions about COVID, which many people would say Boris Johnson has got right in recent months. The huge booster vaccine campaign going on, the economic recovery from COVID, big issues in the world. What are we doing talking about parties? So that's the view. But I would say that's a minority view, because the issue of integrity at the heart of government is one that disturbs people across all political parties.
So I know that, you know, our listeners are generally familiar with clearly the differences between a parliamentary system and, say, the American system. And here, obviously, we have to wait until an election to remove leaders. I mean, the burden on an impeachment obviously is incredibly high. But in a parliamentary system, it's quite different. So maybe can you play out the two sort of scenarios and how, you know, what it would mean? In other words, Boris Johnson survives, but if he survives, how? Is he a caretaker of what, essentially? And on the other hand, you know, obviously Johnson has got a negative last sort of net favorability rating I saw of him was at a negative 52, which is worse than Theresa May's low point. So if he falls, how does that happen? And what do you think the timing is when we would get kind of clarity on direction, barring, of course, some major new revelation, but just the way things are going now?
Yeah. Well, there is a crunch coming soon. Let's take this as a fork in the road. Next, it looks as the time we're speaking, but this has changed in the last few hours, that on Monday next week, this report into what really happened about all these parties will come out. Now, Conservative members of parliament can then launch the process, if they wish, of ousting their leader. These are rules that I wrote 20 years ago, so you are asking the right person. If 15% of the members of parliament, which is 54 MPs in this case, write a confidential letter to the chairman of the party asking for a vote of no confidence, then a vote of no confidence is held very quickly, usually within 24 hours. Which is a straight yes or no ballot of all the Conservative MPs. Do you want him to carry on or not? So he could, in that scenario, as early as next week, he could just be knocked out as prime minister, although he would have to serve until somebody else had been elected. In that scenario, well, then there is an election in the Conservative Party for their new leader, and that takes place, first of all, among the members of parliament until there are two candidates, and then it goes out to the party membership for a vote. So it's kind of the final bit is like a primary, but with gatekeepers, something that might be not a bad idea in the United States, where actually the party elders, as it were, narrow it down to two candidates, and then it goes out for a bigger public vote. That takes at least 2 months. So there would be quite a hiatus in British government. And a lot of pressure for that fiscal loosening that I was talking about, because what are you going to do if you're a candidate for prime minister? Well, the first thing I will do is cancel the tax increase that's coming in April. So you would immediately get that debate. So that's a scenario in which he is deposed. There is a scenario, I think most policies would carry on the same, but with that pressure to spend more and tax less. And the whole direction of Brexit and so on would remain the same. Then the other scenario, there are many ways he can survive, but not enough signatures are. And a key way in which he could survive is there are enough signatures to call a leadership ballot, but then he wins the ballot. And when that happens, our rules say you can't challenge him again for another year. Now, if he can't be challenged for another year, you are in by 2023, you're into the pre-election period in British politics. So if he won a ballot, he was challenged but won a ballot, he'd probably be staying there all that time. Then it's very hard to answer your final part of your question about, well, how does he then shape up against the Labour Party? Because, yes, he is unpopular at the moment, and he must have sustained a lot of permanent political damage from these scandals. On the other hand, he's a remarkable one-off politician. And everybody in America knows something about remarkable one-off politicians, I think. And he's a proven election winner. He's won elections that other conservatives couldn't win, as mayor of London twice, and then a landslide victory at the last general election. So he's never to be written off, actually. He's an extraordinary... I describe him as a chaotic genius. You know, he is a political genius in many ways, but he has a chaotic environment around him in his working environment, which is producing these problems that are coming up. So those are your two scenarios. And I don't know which one will. Nobody knows which one. He doesn't know. Nobody has a clue which one will happen. They say politics is about predicting what will happen next week, next year, and then explaining afterwards why it didn't happen. And I think that might be the case here.
Sounds like my job right there. Now, is it fair though to speculate on who could potentially be teed up to take? Obviously, the names we hear the most are Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe he sits in your old constituency seat, right? And Liz Truss, the Foreign Secretary, who has your old job. So, on the other hand, there's the old adage in the UK, right, that the hand that wields the knife shall never wear the crown. How do the would-be successors kind of stack up, or what's your thinking on that right now?
Well, you're quite right, and here you have to aim off in listening to me for the fact that Rishi Sunak succeeded me in my constituency, or my district, as you would call it in America, and I'm a close friend of his. I talk to him a lot. So I'm obviously very well disposed towards him. He would be the front runner if there was a leadership election, but not the overwhelming front runner. He's enormously respected because he combines an approachability with intelligence and rationality in politics that is a combination that people feel they don't get all the time anymore. And he's a fresh figure he's a fresh and compelling figure. That yes, he would have serious competition from several quarters. You're quite right to mention Liz Truss, the foreign secretary. She's made an impressive start to being foreign secretary, having been the international trade secretary. And one thing, I don't know if we'll get a chance to mention it later, but she has now taken over the negotiations with the EU following the resignation of Lord Frost. And those negotiations are now going much better. There was a much better atmosphere, that there's a better prospect of reaching agreement over the Northern Ireland Protocol, a very difficult issue, and of then moving on from that, if that is resolved, to a better framework of relations with the European Union. So she's, from taking quite a hardline position, she's showing she's a pragmatic politician who can operate on the international stage. So I think also commands a lot of respect. And again, it's hard to say who will, the Conservative leadership election is hardly ever won by the person you think is going to win. You know, when I was elected, nobody, I started out as 66 to 1 against at the betting, with the betting firms, and won. You know, so there may be somebody like me who is going to charge from the back of the pack. But those would be the two front runners to begin with. Again, from a business point of view, that does not mean a major change in policy. It's really important to bear in mind this leadership crisis in Britain is very, very oddly and almost uniquely not about the policies that are being pursued, but about the character and behavior of the Prime Minister and the people around him.
So I want to go back to something you said before, because this does have implications for the fiscal and, say, the tax policy that you mentioned earlier. Now, you know, you've talked about the unique character of Boris Johnson, almost a sui generis kind of premiership that he's built here. And you mentioned that at this point, the Labour Party now has a 10-point lead over the Conservatives. We've seen some by-elections in June and December where the Tories lost what had been safe seats. But I guess, you know, more broadly, you know, Johnson saw through Brexit. Johnson put, you know, kind of oversaw this period of party realignment and has got this unique coalition of the traditional kind of Southern England, the conservative voters in the city and in other places who want that kind of fiscal restraint, and they want lower taxes, and but then also got traditional labor voters in more blue collar areas of the country. So when we look at the would be potential successors or the direction of the Conservative Party in a non-Johnson environment, does that coalition of voters survive him not being at the head anymore? And I guess the broader question beyond that then is, in this realignment, is there an electoral strategy then as we head to national elections at some point in the next couple of years? I know that you were up against Tony Blair essentially in the last big party realignment when he tried to go to the center, and you know, I know you had your issues with Blair, but you always sort of recognized the electoral that they had a strategic outlook to achieve what they did.
Yes, well, the answer to that question is the realignment in British politics that you're describing isn't particular to Boris Johnson. He's been a very good example of it and very good at bringing that new coalition of voters to life, but it was taking shape a long time before him, and in it, you can see it under David Cameron and then particularly under Theresa May, particularly once Brexit comes along and once immigration became a very big issue, that realignment took place where much more of what we used to call the working class, we've moved on from those terms now, but you know what I mean, you can picture what I mean, became conservative. In fact, at the last general election, this was the first time in British political history that the average income of the conservative voters was lower than the Labour voters. That's never happened before. But it was a trend. It didn't just happen. It happened over many elections, a trend in that direction, as the Labour Party has become separated from its original trade union working class base. Those people are often very hardline on immigration and on crime, and they think the Labour Party has been going on about minority issues and have gone off to the Conservatives, often going via the UK Independence Party, which introduced them to the idea of not voting Labour anymore. They don't easily go back again. And now the Conservative Party has to really deliver for those voters, though. And so another thing, a big thing to watch out for, actually, in British politics in the next 10 days or 2 weeks, maybe held up a little bit by the problems we've just been discussing, is the so-called levelling up white paper. This is the these are going to be the government proposals on how you level up the rest of it, the left behind towns of the country. There's a lot of expectation pinned on that. So there is, the Conservative Party has a political strategy to succeed on Brexit, to show that it's using Brexit to secure the country's borders and so on, and then to deliver better results for those left behind towns, which is designed to maintain its coalition of support. And it's still a big, big challenge for the Labour Party to win the next election. It would have to have the biggest movement in votes in one go seen since the election in 1945 at the end of the Second World War, in order to go from this position to their own majority at the next election.
So I know you mentioned earlier that Liz Truss had taken over the sort of managing the relationship with Europe on the management of the sort of the post-Brexit relationship between the UK and the EU. But when you step back, when you consider everything that you have just said about the direction of travel of British politics and the party realignments and so on, what are the consequences of all of this for Brexit and the things that sort of remain, you know, the big picture things that need to be resolved on the Northern Ireland Protocol and trade agreements and the like? I mean, what has to happen now to really make Brexit work for the UK? I mean, when we think back to the original negotiation, I mean, one of the things that we always talk about in sort of the political risk business is how, you know, there's always this sort of assumption on Wall Street and in the city and places like that, that, you know, that the actors are economically rational actors. And yet, you know, the competitive advantage of, say, the financial services industry in the UK, which is such a bigger part of British GDP than American GDP, as an example, was sort of, it got second, you know, short shrift in the negotiations in a way. So I guess, where do you see Brexit going from here, and how do you make it work?
Well, I think it's very clear that there's only one big, there's one strategy for Brexit. People may have superimposed on Brexit when they voted for it many different hopes, you know, and we can now see that most of those were not justified. I speak as someone who was against Brexit, so again, you have to you have to allow for that. If I sound biased in any way, but some people thought we could have a low tax paradise. Well, look what we're debating. We're debating which tax increases to go ahead with after COVID. So that's not going to happen. Some people thought we would have radically different free trade deals with the rest of the world. Well, we're doing pretty well on free trade deals, but they mainly replicate the previous free trade deals through the EU. There were one or two good innovations in new deals with Australia, for instance, that couldn't have been done in the EU, but they're broadly the same. So it's not that is radically different. Other people thought we might be a place of really minimal regulation, you know, of lower standards, if you like. But no, not at all. We are raising our minimum wage. We are adopting many green and environmental standards, more so than most countries. So it's not that. So what is it then? Well, in my view, it's one thing. It is that the UK is in a very strong position to pursue an innovation of an agenda of innovation, of the science superpower, if you like. In an age of rapid technological change in the next 10 years, the combination of some of the best universities in the world, the concentration of talent in this country on things like fintech and other areas of innovation, the tremendously strong base in medical innovation. This country did extremely well with the development and rollout of vaccines. And the opening up of immigration to the higher paid potential immigrants, the professors, the doctors, the scientists, and so on, because all limits have been removed from that. That combination, supported by more government support, Rishi Sunak is hugely increasing the government spending on research and development. That gives the country a chance to go for leadership in Europe and the whole science and innovation area. Now, a lot of that it could have done inside the EU anyway, but there are some areas where it can design its regulations for that purpose. Ursula von der Leyen, President of the European Commission, said on vaccines, the UK had been a speedboat where the EU was a super tanker, and that's why we got to our goal much faster. Now, can we do that on a whole range of other? Can we do that on gene editing? Can we do that on our data regulation so people want to hold their data in the UK? Can we do it in financial services? So even though parts of financial services have lost markets in Europe, the competitive advantage of how it's regulated in the UK draws global markets to the UK. So you can argue Brexit either way for financial services. Now, the jury is still out on whether Britain will do all this, but in the mind of, you were asking about Rishi Sunak earlier, this is what Brexit is. It is really getting ahead, and therefore there is a very positive agenda for it. And I would say, well, that's what we have to give. We have to really give that a go, because there isn't anything else. There's no other strategy that is a new post-Brexit strategy.
So how does that, that's very ambitious, although you've got the foundation, as you've talked about it, but it does remind me of a lot of the challenges we have here in the United States on this very front. That, in other words, those industries, those sort of initiatives that you're talking about, those new areas of technological innovation and development, clearly favors those who are highly educated, right? And these centers that you're talking about around places like Cambridge and Oxford, and these ecosystems that built up around the prestige universities and the like. So again, going back then to the political alignment in the country, how do you champion those things and then also not have the kind of left behind gap that we see? Secondly, and this is a debate that's ongoing in the United States, but obviously immigration was a part of the Brexit debate, as an example. Some of the most talented people in the world are immigrants to the education, the secondary and university level educations in the United States and in the United Kingdom. We always point out in the U.S. that Tesla, Amazon, Google, Apple, all founded by either immigrants or children of immigrants, critical to innovation. And then also the other thing the U.S. has is a very efficient capital allocation system to find these ideas and be able to scale them up from Kickstarter to angel investors, venture capital, private equity, New York listings, an efficient bankruptcy system. Basically, we have a very efficient way of championing and scaling up new technology. So how do you achieve all of that with those issues?
That's quite a list of requirements. They're all really important points. And I think the answer to the first one is, of course, they're never going to be able to create an Oxford and a Cambridge all over the UK. However, if that leveling up white paper that I was just talking about, I do know that Michael Gove, the minister who is writing that, feels it's extremely important to show that it can lead to clusters of innovation in parts of the country where that isn't happening so far. And the British government is putting a huge effort into getting major new facilities, you know, some of these huge new battery manufacturing facilities that are coming with electric cars into the north of England, so that really it starts fertilizing a new a cluster of innovation in a new part of the economy. But of course, that's a huge challenge. It's really important not to hold back the Oxford, the Cambridge, the Imperial College, you know, in doing so.
I want to move on here, though, in just a second, but I did want to ask one final question, because something that probably hasn't been on the American radar screen with regards to UK politics since the referendum is the Scotland question. But with all of the realignments, Scotland obviously voted overwhelmingly to remain in the EU at the time of the Brexit vote, and the like. Is the Scottish question going to come up again? And, you know, is there a real possibility that that the integrity of the United Kingdom will come into question again?
There is a real possibility. For someone like me, who a Eurosceptic for a long time, but I was against Brexit, this was one of the main reasons I was against it, that I thought it could, over time, unravel the United Kingdom. It certainly has given a new argument to the Scottish National Party that they could leave the UK and join the EU. Now, the problem for them, though, is opinion hasn't yet really changed in Scotland. So that they have a strategic political problem, which is they've got a majority for Scottish independence in the Parliament in Scotland, but they couldn't guarantee winning a referendum. It's usually sort of 52-48, the wrong way around, if you ask people in polls. So they have to keep raising the temperature of this issue without bringing it to the boil when they haven't actually got a majority in the country. And that's what you'll see, I think, over the next 2 years, where the Scottish nationalists try to show that they have the right to hold a referendum, that they've got a clear plan for a referendum. But they would be a bit worried if we said, OK, let's have it next week then. So I think this will go through the next general election with them claiming if they win a majority of seats again in Scotland, then a mandate for a referendum. I think eventually a British government would have to agree to hold another referendum if there was a constant desire in Scotland. But I see this really playing out in a referendum is more likely in 2025 or 26 than in 23 after another British general election. And it's the Scottish nationalists have a big problem conceptually as well now with how do you leave the UK and join the EU with a gap in between? And particularly, what do you do with the currency? The last time there was a referendum, they were going to keep the pound, even though that would have meant they weren't really a sovereign country. Now they are meant to ditch the pound. But they also, if they were going to join the EU, would have to join the euro eventually. Then they'd have to have another currency in the middle. Well, you can see the problems that might arise with maintaining the value of assets in Scotland in that time. So it's not a it's a problem, and it's a risk mid-2020s. But it would be wrong to think that there's unstoppable momentum behind Scottish nationalism.
So I want to pivot now and ask you to put on your old foreign secretary hat, and you know, the big geopolitical story of the day is clearly the situation around Russia and Ukraine. And maybe, you know, before we talk about the UK's interests here, I'm just interested to know, as you obviously dealt with Russia in over the years, what is your view of what is happening right now? How do you see it playing out? And where do you think, I mean, you know, Putin is a perfect example of someone who doesn't always act in what would perceive to be his near-term economic self-interest, and has shown that time and again. So it makes his actions all the more unpredictable in many ways. But how do you see all of this playing out, and in the context of the diplomacy that the U.S., the NATO, the U.K. independently, the European Union, as well as its constituents, everybody's got, there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen right now, in theory, all trying to head off war. But how do you see it
Well, that's another big question. I wrote an article this week recalling how I'm one of the few people who's discussed, few people in the West, who's discussed with Putin for several hours the best way to bring down your opponent. So I have some insight into his mind. That's because we have a thing in common, which is judo. I'm a judo enthusiast. He's well known as that. So I got designated to take him to the London Olympics to watch the judo. And it was quite instructive. And you can imagine he has a really strong sense of when the opponent is off balance. That's different from being weak, just off balance. And the West is off balance at the moment. The chaotic retreat from Kabul, a new government in Germany finding its feet, the Biden administration with so many priorities at home and abroad, and the Biden administration trying to switch to a focus on China and perhaps to close down other areas of difficulty in foreign policy. Putin sees all that as being off balance. That's a moment that might not repeat itself to take advantage. And in particular, the desire of the president, I think, to do deals with Putin, to quite correctly, to renew the START treaty, New START on nuclear warheads, and to come to some agreement on stopping cyber attacks on American government and public institutions. That's a moment for Putin to say, well, I want my deal, which won't cost you anything. It's just this country, Ukraine, that is an irritant to all of us as he sees it. And, you know, it costs nothing to say, well, they're not joining NATO and they're not going to have any weapons and so on. So I think he genuinely wants a deal, Putin, although he's asked for a maximalist position. I don't think the West can give him and should give him what he wants. He wants us to disown our values and our friends and to give in to the threat of armed aggression. And it's not a good idea to give in to that threat, because soon there's another threat to do the next thing. So I think the United States and the UK in particular and the West in general have responded correctly, not been provocative, but been firm and come up with ideas for other agreements and been arming people in Ukraine at the same time. A free country is entitled to defend itself. So I think that's all been done correctly. But what would then happen? Well, of course, really hard to predict. The other insight into the mind of the judo player is you keep all your options to the last millisecond as to whether you're going to sweep your opponent's feet from under you. And I particularly discussed with Putin at the judo the other option, which is you slowly constrain them. You get into a better position where they can't breathe and they can't stand up straight and their morale goes down, and then you sweep their feet from under them. Now that you might want to do that with Ukraine. And so he's got all his military options open. What's my guess? My guess is that there's still some chance of some kind of agreement, but it's pretty small. That probably won't happen. He can't just climb down and do nothing. So that means it's more than likely there will be some kind of military incursion into Ukraine. It's quite possible, though, that it's a sort of gradualist thing, that it's to keep the West off balance. To annex the Donbass, to make a move on towards a land bridge with Crimea. Less likely, but possible, is the lightning the invasion from three sides, encircle Kiev, destroy all the UK, the Ukraine weapons production, demand the fall of the Ukrainian political institutions. That's less likely. The thing he really has to worry about is with all these anti-tank missiles going in and anti-aircraft shoulder launch missiles, that a protracted conflict could turn out quite badly for Russia, in my view.
Given what you just laid out about the challenges of the sort of the traditional full-on invasion that many people worry about, that it would cost him economically, it would cost him in blood and treasure, right? There would be an insurgency and there would be pushback and, you know, and Russian soldiers would go home in body bags over time. It would be costly and there would be international opprobrium. He would be an international pariah for having done that. And yet, while that's an unlikely scenario, it is not a zero scenario. What would catalyze him to actually take that incredibly costly and very, very risky move, in your view?
Well, I think if he thought that it was doable, even at that price, to take the greater part of Ukraine back into Russia, or all of Ukraine back into Russia, as he sees it, back into, you know, the czarist Russia, then that would be a price worth paying, because that would be of world historical importance. These other things would, all the things you list would hurt for a few years, but the geography of the planet would be changed, in his view, on a permanent basis. And the security of Russia, as he sees it, guaranteed in many respects for the future. And he would see it as a huge boost to his regime, seeing it in domestic political terms. So if he thought that was doable, I think he would do that. Now, is it doable? That's the problem for him. There's a domestic population that would be very resistant to that, and a Western world that would give them a lot of help, even though we would not have our own armed intervention. So that's why he's more likely to do that more gradual thing. So the bad news is this could go on for quite a long time, because he could do something and then say, well, I've gone this far, but now we better talk so I don't go further. And then, you know, with a division of opinion between Washington and London on the one hand and Berlin on the other about how you then react to that, that is the attractive route for him when you weigh these pros and cons.
In your view, is the credibility of the West or the Western alliance kind of on the line here to a certain degree? I mean, one of the central tenets of coming out of World War II was that the redrawing of maps by force would not happen. And indeed, you know, Saddam Hussein's incursion into Kuwait and George H.W. Bush and the alliance pushing him out, you know, was indication of the West standing behind that principle. And many are talking about how China, with its views on, say, Taiwan, as an example, watching this situation very, very carefully about how feckless the United States and the West might actually be. How do you see Western credibility in this?
Well, I think the ability to muster a strong and largely united reaction from the West, and we've seen that ability in the last couple of weeks, shows that there's still a lot of fight in the West and a lot of solidarity in the West. But the credibility is on the line, yes, particularly after Afghanistan. Now, Afghanistan was a disaster. And a totally unnecessary disaster. Without pretending there were any easy choices, the wrong choice was made. It was possible broadly to maintain a difficult status quo. And instead, there was a completely mismanaged withdrawal, which has left Western credibility and influence in Central Asia and the Middle East much reduced. So if there is another retreat, on top of that, on the continent of Europe, well, that would be extremely serious. So therefore, this is a foreign policy moment of enormous significance. And this is the danger of it, that Putin, having built this up now, can't really just do nothing at all. But the West can't say, well, we don't really care about it. You know, you've got a point. Ukraine is in no man's land and can't ever be anything else. So why don't we just give up on it? They can't do that either. So that's why this is not to be underestimated, the danger of this situation.
You know, you talked about your connecting with him over judo, which gave you certain sort of insight into how he thinks. You know, George W. Bush famously looked into his eyes and saw his soul and saw somebody who could do business with Hillary and Barack Obama attempted to reset. Trump had this sort of unique relationship and feelings toward Putin. But Putin has been around for a long time. I mean, it's amazing when you just run through that list of names, how many leaders he has survived. And so we should know him well. Why is it that the West continues to get tied up? I understand everything you say. He's a master tactician. But why can we not get him right, in a sense?
Well, I think we probably do understand him well now, but we can't give him what he wants. He's created his own insecurity. Because if you build a pyramid of financial and political power in Russia, which really cannot permit an opening up, a political or economic, certainly a political opening up, and which sees the development of neighboring countries in a more democratic direction as a threat, well, then it's quite hard to help that person. He's created his own insecurity. He could have taken Russia in a different direction. He wouldn't have been in power forever, but he could have taken a different direction and retired gracefully. And he could have done much more to diversify the economy of Russia away from being a petrostate. So in a way, he's created his own problem and now feels threatened with having that problem. That's quite hard to assist, I think. So that's our problem. You know, in order to make himself secure, everybody else has to pay a price that they're not willing to pay, and that's very hard to make them pay that price.
You know, it all kind of brings us back to what we were talking about at the beginning, which was UK politics, because the UK has engaged in this as a with its foreign policy apparatus. And in fact, in quite an extraordinary move last weekend, went public with intelligence that they suggested Russia was going to attempt to install a pro-Russian leader in Ukraine. And I wonder if, you know, to what degree, I mean, on the one hand, there is this sort of unprecedented public diplomacy that's going on, being pushed by the U.S., by Europe, and so on. A lot of that would typically have happened kind of behind closed doors. I think that they're attempting to, A, call out and not lose the narrative battle with Russia, but also give Putin as many off ramps as possible. But I also wonder, you know, how to contextualize this in what the UK is attempting to assert vis-a-vis the other big European powers, Germany and France, in particular. Is there any element here of trying to deflect away from Boris's problems? Somebody said the other day, like, the only thing that's more dangerous than a populist who's in trouble is two populists in trouble. But obviously, you know, the UK has got some very legitimate gripes and issues with Russia, going all the way back to, like, the Litvinenko assassination and the attempted assassinations of the Skripals. And yet, there's also a lot of, you know, all you have to do is run around Belgravia and Mayfair, and you see a lot of Russian money sloshing around as well. So, talk about the UK and how this is contextualize the UK's foreign policy position and relations with Europe in dealing with these types of issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, the UK's foreign policy has changed with Brexit because it has lost one of its important areas of influence. You know, when I was foreign secretary, which was 2010, 2014, we were in the EU. You were seated at every table. It's a wonderful thing for the UK that if I was working as I worked very hard on stabilizing Somalia and ending piracy in the Indian Ocean, well, I had the seat of the UN Security Council to legitimize a new government in Somalia, and I had the UK military working with a strong military working with others to start dealing with the pirates. I had all the Commonwealth connections with East African countries to mobilize them for the right objectives, and a seat in the EU to get them to pay the Africans to do the fighting on the ground. You know, so you really could marshal all these things as the British Foreign Secretary. And now you can still do that, but without the EU part. You can't deliver the EU. So now that's an important loss of foreign policy influence. But all those other things are still there, including this very strong military and diplomatic connection with the United States. And so the UK is now maintaining all of those things and creating new alliances in the world. The AUKUS alliance, the Australia-UK-United States alliance, initially about submarines, but yeah, it's meant to be about a lot more than submarines, is an example of that. And on something like the Ukraine crisis, it means, okay, the UK will not be sitting at the table if it comes to sanctions on Russia, helping decide what the EU sanctions are. However, you can't make European sanctions effective without the UK. It's the biggest financial center in Europe. The UK can influence them in a different way, which is say, we're just announcing our own sanctions, which could be, for instance, aligned with the United States. And now what we're setting a standard for the EU. So it can have a leadership, right? And in this particular case, the UK is very active, flying 2,000 anti-tank guided missiles recently into Ukraine. And the UK has the airlift capability and the reserves of weapons to do that, which most European countries don't. So I suppose this is a long way of saying that the UK has retained most of its reach in the world, even after Brexit. It's lost one. It just can't deliver another 27 countries with it all the time. But it can sometimes it can still have a leading role in relation to those 27 other countries. And so that's not, if I think of all the problems of Brexit, you know, I would say, yes, there's this problem to the future unity of the UK that we've discussed. There's a definite loss of economic output and trade, probably about 4% of the GDP of the country. But there isn't a tremendous loss of foreign policy and security policy reach and influence. And the UK is still able to play nothing like the role of the United States, but a very important second tier role.
Yeah, you know, you talk about a lot of the historic and sort of structural strengths that the UK has as a financial center with a permanent seat on the Security Council, one of the most formidable expeditionary capable militaries in the world. But of course, one of the big force multipliers for the UK for a long time has been the so-called special relationship with the United States. Now, you've referenced this a couple times, talking about the AUKUS submarine deal and which you know strengthens the UK's position in the pivot to the Indo-Pacific, et cetera. But there are other areas where perhaps the US hasn't prioritized the UK, let's say, over Europe or something. In the sort of post-Brexit environment, is the relationship with the US playing out the way that the advocates of the freedoms that would be granted to the UK by being outside of Europe, but expecting that the brother would be there in the same way at all times? Is that playing out the way that was expected?
I think there's one big gap, and that is the lack of a free trade agreement with the United States. However, it has to be said, of course, everybody struggles to make free trade agreements with the United States at the moment. And yeah. That's a disappointment to the advocates of Brexit. We have so much trade and commerce with the United States already that the quantifiable benefits of a free trade agreement are meant to be relatively small in any case. But it was a totemic thing to hope for. And we've got our free trade agreements now with Australia and Japan and working on with India, but no sign of one with the United States. However, that doesn't mean that the UK feels somehow abandoned by the United States. You know, the first country the new president came to was here in Britain, the closest intelligence, nuclear, military, diplomatic relations are with the United States, and that remains the case. And it's when there's a crisis like this over Putin and the Ukraine that everybody in Washington is reminded who their really closest and most useful ally is. So we're not the oldest ally. Notice American leaders always call France correctly the oldest ally. But they don't say it's the closest, most useful, most supportive, most helpful. So I think that's still there. I'm still quite upbeat about the UK-US relationship.
So I know that, and last question for you, William, is I know you talk to and advise, any number of CEOs and corporate leaders, not just in the UK, but in the US as well, and in other places. In this complicated environment, even beyond all the subjects we've covered here today, what are they expressing to you their greatest concerns about, and what are you telling them?
Well, our greatest concerns are often about the unpredictability of the political world that we've just been talking about and the extent of polarization the political world. And then there are other things that I tell them they ought to be worried about or that they're thinking more about. And top of my list is Africa, that Africa will assume an importance in world affairs in the next 20 years that it's never had in the whole history of human civilization. And that's both a vast opportunity and also carries many risks. Certainly the future of Africa will decide the fate of Europe.
And that's a function of demographics plus the energy transition and the importance of...
Yes. It's demographics exacerbated by climate change, energy transition, but particularly demographics. That's the one part of the world where the population is still booming. Vast mega cities of young people are arising in Africa and parts of the Middle East and nowhere else in the world. And so that's a quite different way of thinking about the world from the last 30 years. And the other thing I think, which they raise and which I also raise a lot, is it's obvious we're entering the fastest decade of technological innovation ever in human history. There are many good reasons for that. And it's very, very exciting that is happening. But that will have a profound effect on international relations. And I would rank alongside climate change at the arrival of artificial intelligence as something that is a massive opportunity, but massive risk for the world. To quote the recent book by Henry Kissinger and Eric Schmidt, the introduction of non-human logic to military deterrence raises profound new challenges. I think that was the sentence. That's what it meant. And this is a subject coming down the tracks very, very quickly and of massive ethical, political, and diplomatic implications.
Well, we're at the bottom of the hour. And so, William, I hope you'll come back. You've been a great guest many times on this program. And you've just touched on a few subjects right there that I'd love to uncover with you. So hopefully we'll have you back again this year. But I want to thank you very much for joining us.
So there you have it. I'm Kevin Kachawara. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Teneo Insights. If you have any questions about any of the topics we cover, please reach out to us at teneoinsights@teneo.com. See you next time.